All right, let's go ahead and get started. Wow, I'm surprised to see how many of you have recovered already from the concert last night. I heard that a lot of people were missing. Looks like a pretty good crowd. Congratulations on making it here by now. All right, so my topic this morning is going to be game theory versus entrepreneurs, or entrepreneurs versus game theory. Now, to make it clear before I lay out, I'm not so much saying that game theory is something we should totally throw out and as useless. I'm just saying that we need to consider the reality of entrepreneurship whenever we try to apply game theory. And I'd also suggest that a lot of the standard applications that we see of game theory don't take entrepreneurship into account, and therefore are extremely misleading. I think, actually, I'm not the only Austrian that has a somewhat positive view that game theory might be useful. If you look at Rothbard's first appendix, I believe, in Main Economy and State, he lays out various fields of praxeology. And in that, he says, well, one would be Robinson Crusoe economics, how an individual would act in isolation. Another would be catalactics, or how a market economy works. And he says that some strides have been made toward a theory of games, or game theory. Right, so it is considered, at least by Rothbard, to be part of the logical study of human action that we would call praxeology. Okay. So how would I define game theory? I'm not going to. Instead, I'll just say what it's used for. Game theory is, I guess, a method that we use to describe the behavior of small groups where one actor has a big impact on the other actors involved. Right, so typically we'd say if we have a very... say, just a small group of people making decisions, game theory might apply here. It could apply to quite literal games. We could apply game theory to a game of chess, say. It gets extremely complicated, too, but you could, in theory, do that. Or often we'd use it, say, if we have just a few firms that are operating in a particular market, how are they going to interact with each other? Is a very typical application for game theory. So it's used to describe how these small groups interact. And as we look at their interactions, we can find out sometimes we end up with really odd results. The most important one, or perhaps the most famous, being the prisoner's dilemma, where the story is that we have two prisoners that have been caught collaborating in some type of crime, and then they're brought into the police station, they're separated, and they're given the choice of either confessing to this horrible crime or not. Now, the way that things are set up, I have here the numbers are all a number of years they can expect to spend in prison in each situation. All right, so it ends up, if neither of them confesses, so the first prisoner chooses to confess or not, they don't. Second prisoner confesses or doesn't, they don't. If neither of them confess, we end up in this cell, where each of them gets 5 years in prison. Kind of the story here is the police said, well, okay, if you don't confess to this great crime, but we can still get you on some kind of lesser charge, like tax evasion or something like that. You're still going to spend some time in prison. So your benefit then is, rather than not confessing, suppose that the other person doesn't confess on you, right? So let's say the first prisoner isn't going to confess, right? Prisoner number two can either not confess and spend 5 years in prison, or can confess, right? At which point they get off scot-free, right? They help the police, so okay, it's a nice plea bargain. But in exchange, we got prisoner one for a very serious charge. They spend 20 years in prison. Now, naturally, prisoner number one would not like this. 20 years in prison is terrible. So they, in fact, have a reason to confess as well. Right. 20 years is not good, but if I confess, I can at least say, well, at least I admitted my guilt, and that would lessen my prison sentence. Right. So we end up, when we examine the incentives, we find out our second prisoner, if they believe the first prisoner is not going to confess, they want to go ahead and confess so they can get off scot-free. Right. If they believe the first prisoner will confess, they still want to go ahead and confess, because 10 years in prison is better than 20. And so either way, it looks like the prisoner that's choosing our column, right, decides to confess. Right. Using the same type of argument, the prisoner choosing the row says, well, if the other guy confesses, as we know they're going to, right, if I confess as well, I get 10 years in prison, that's better than 20. If for some reason they decided not to confess, 0 is still better than 5. Right. So either way, it looks like the prisoner choosing the row also wants to confess. So we end up with this outcome, right, where both our prisoners confess, and they both end up in prison for 10 years. Right. Now, if you're having some doubts, first let me comfort you. You're not alone. Normally when I teach this example in my Principles of Micro class, students say, wait, you know, why would they do this when they can both obviously be made better off if neither of them confess? Right. 5 years in prison for both of us is obviously better than 10 years in prison for both of us, unless for some reason we like being in prison. Assume that away, say prison is bad. Okay. So we should end up here, right? Which is really kind of the story of The Prisoner's Dilemma. And it's the point that John Nash, if you've seen A Beautiful Mind, it's all about John Nash. The point that he was trying to make is that while individually we're each doing what makes sense, right, it ends up with this bad collective outcome that we could actually improve, and all agree we could improve. It just doesn't make sense for us individually to end up here. Okay. And I think we should, though, trust those doubts that you have. And I'll get to why in just a moment. Okay. This is The Prisoner's Dilemma. It has lots of applications. You can see we apply it to, say, cartels with whether we're going to collude or not. We can apply it to trade policy. Are we going to be protectionist or have free trade? And we find that there are incentives for everyone to end up being protectionist. We can apply it to things like baseball players, whether or not they use steroids. We can actually put that in a game theory kind of setup. Same thing with tobacco advertising. Another one that I'll talk about is the funding for public goods. Oh, wow. Must have hit the focus somewhere. Auto. Oh, that's a little better. Technology is incredible, isn't it? You hit just an autofocus button, and it's amazing. Okay. All right, so here, one of the problems that you might hear about in standard economics class is there's a class of goods we call public goods. Often you might talk about, say, lighthouses or the military being a public good, where it has the property that it's remarkably difficult to force someone to pay for the thing. Right? If, after all, we have a military that is protecting my neighbor's house, they are, by extension, going to be protecting my house, even if I refuse to pay for that military to be there. Right? Which then creates a problem of how do we get anybody to pay for it and actually end up with the good being provided. Now, the standard argument would go something like this. Right? So suppose we have two people here. It's a much smaller society than we have in the U.S., but we can actually tell the story in this game theoretic way. Right. And if we both pay, then we're splitting the cost of this public good, and it ends up, on the whole, being a good value for both of us. Right. While I may not be willing to pay for the entire military myself, for obvious reasons, it's outrageously expensive for the very small value that I individually would get. Right. I would probably be willing to pay my small part of the overall cost. Right. So if we both pay, we both get a good value. Right. If neither of us pay, we end up without the good being provided. Nobody's paying for it, so it doesn't exist. Right. So we end up with, I'll just put a zero there. Right. Now, where things are kind of odd is in the case where one player pays and the other one doesn't. Right. In that case, the player that pays, say that five times fast. Right. The player that pays ends up overpaying because they have to bear the full cost of providing this good and making sure that it is provided, while the payer that doesn't pay gets this good for free. It's very difficult to prevent them from benefiting from the thing and therefore to force them to pay for it. You can't do that. They just get it for free. Right, so when we start drawing our arrows, we find out that the player choosing our column says, well, okay, if the other guy's going to pay, I could either pay my fair share and get a good value for it, or I could just not pay and get the thing for free. Right. Well, this person's anything like me, they'd rather just get the thing for free. All right. So, okay, we'll get the thing for free. On the other hand, if I think I can't convince this other person to pay for it, I could either pay for it to make sure it's provided, at which point I'm not getting as much value as what I have to pay to get the thing. So I'd rather not pay for it at all. All right. So the player that's choosing the column decides, no, I'm not going to pay for the good. Right. Making the same type of argument. Trust I don't have to walk through the same steps because they're, in fact, identical. We end up with the don't row being chosen. Right, so we end up with this horrible problem where if we leave these two people to themselves, right, we don't get the public good provided. Despite the fact that they both agree that if only we could have a way for us both to pay for it, we'd end up with a good value on the whole. Right, so generally at this point, your professor would say something like, this is why we need taxes. Right? We need taxes because if we can force these people to pay for the thing, in fact, people like it. In the end, yes, I'm very happy to pay my taxes because I do get a good value as long as you force everyone else to pay their taxes too. Right? We're all paying our fair share, being the phrase. Okay. We could also apply this to the tragedy of the commons in a very similar way, except there it's about use versus not use. We end up overusing the commons. So say we fish too much in international waters that aren't well regulated. So we need regulation on these types of things would be the general conclusion. Okay. So a number of things that might be labeled market failures in a standard principles class, we can actually put in this world of game theory. Okay. So that's game theory. Now let's talk a little bit about entrepreneurs and how they may change the story. I suggest that in the Austrian tradition, there are really two ways of looking at the entrepreneur, and we can apply both of them, right, in this situation. One, Mises's view is really that entrepreneurs provide foresight, and that what you're really good at if you're an entrepreneur is foreseeing what is it people are going to want, and making plans in order to make sure people actually get what they want. While the Kirzner view would be more that entrepreneurs are people who are especially alert to opportunities. Right? So there are opportunities out there that most people are just too blind to see, but as an entrepreneur, you're someone who is not so blind. Right? And the way that I think of the Kirznerian entrepreneur, I don't know whether this is an example I read in his book or whether it's just a way that I thought of it. So I remember in high school, the bell would ring for everybody to come inside. Inevitably, it seems like we all try to squeeze through the right-hand door. Right here in the States, everybody walks on the right, so we all squeeze through one door, despite the fact that the left door is unlocked. Right? It's perfectly possible for someone to grab it and open it. The Kirznerian entrepreneur is the person who opens that door. Right? The opportunity is there for anybody. The Kirznerian entrepreneur says, wait a minute, let's open the door. It will make it easier for everybody. We're all going in the same direction. It doesn't create any problem. Okay. So let's combine these two. Right? If we have a Mises-Kirzner entrepreneur, well, what is this type of person? Right? It's somebody who's very alert to opportunities, and not only opportunities that are already existent, but those that will arise in the future. Right? So we add foresight to this alertness. Right? So I see things coming, right? I'm aware that they're going to come, and I'm alert to ways that I can try to deal with them. Okay. So here we need to be somewhat realistic in the prisoner's dilemma. Right? But the reality is, if I can find my notes first, if we are committing this crime and we're entrepreneurial prisoners, I guess entrepreneurial criminals at first, right, we're going to see this coming. Right? But the reality is that if we have reasonably good foresight, we know there's a good chance we're going to get caught. Right? So we're going to have to come up with some kind of plan for how we're going to deal with that situation. Right? Now, knowing the kind of deal the police are going to give us, it's not really a good deal. We know it's going to end up with a bad outcome. Well, it ends up, if we foresee that this game is coming ahead of time, there's no reason we can't change the rules. Right? Underlying all game theory, anytime you lay out something like a prisoner's dilemma or what have you, we're making the assumption, right, that all these payoffs are right. Right. There's nothing we can do to change them. Right. Once you add foresight to the game, things become a little bit less clear. Right? So, for example, we could imagine our two very entrepreneurial criminals saying, well, I know that when we get caught, you're going to be very tempted to confess. So I'm willing to strike a deal with you, and we're going to hire this third criminal that's going to stand outside the police station, right, or stand outside the prison, whichever. Right? And their job is to break the knees of anyone who confesses. Right? Okay, we're criminals. We don't care about this as violating your property rights, whatever. That doesn't matter. They're going to break the knees of anyone who confesses. Right? If we both confess, fine, we both end up with broken kneecaps. If only one of us confesses, the one gets broken kneecaps. Okay, so what we're really doing is taking the game and changing it. Right? So if we confess, right, now all of our payoffs change. So it's not just 10 years in prison here, it's 10 years plus, I'm going to abbreviate it, BK for broken kneecaps, right? Plus broken kneecaps here as the confessor. The same thing here, plus broken kneecaps, plus broken kneecaps. Right? And this very well could change our incentives, right? I guess it depends on how much I care about broken kneecaps versus time in prison, right? Maybe, okay, I don't care about broken kneecaps that much, so I'd still rather have no time in prison plus broken kneecaps than 5 years in prison. Okay, but if we're good entrepreneurial criminals, we'll understand this about our partner. Say, okay, you don't care about your kneecaps, well, we'll find something you do care about, right? Maybe your skull, right? Maybe your family, right? We'll find something, right, to make getting this time off worse than just sitting in prison for 5 years, right? We change the game. So I'd suggest what entrepreneurs can do with good foresight, with good alertness to ways to deal with these things, is they can change the game on us. And that totally reverses the outcome we can get. Just make this punishment bad enough, right, and people will stop confessing. Right? And the reality seems to be that there's a lot of that actually goes on. Right? Just recently, I think it was in the past week or two, it came out, there were a couple of researchers at the University of Hamburg that actually ran experiments with the prisoner's dilemma with actual prisoners. Right? So people who are in this institution, it was for female prisoners in particular, right? So it was a women's institution. And they had them play a prisoner's dilemma sort of game. Now, it wasn't for time off of prison. They didn't have the freedom to do that. Instead, they did something like, I believe the rewards were cigarettes or coffee, right, whichever of these the person wanted. Right. So if you play the less cooperative strategy, if you do the equivalent of confessing, then you have the opportunity to get more coffee or more cigarettes than if you didn't confess. Well, except in this combined sense. Right, so individually, you're increasing how many cigarettes you have. You're better off. But collectively, you'd end up worse off if you both play this uncooperative strategy rather than the cooperative strategy. Okay. What they ended up finding was that over half of the prisoners that they used actually played a more cooperative strategy, which is kind of wild. Right? We're putting people in this situation where confess or don't, and over half of them decide not to. That suggests either these prisoners aren't particularly intelligent or don't care about themselves, right? Or there's something else going on. Yeah. Half the individuals. Yeah. Yeah. If you looked at the pairs, I believe it was 30% of the pairs had both choosing the more cooperative strategy. Yeah. Okay. Which is kind of interesting. Right? If we take the original prisoner's dilemma seriously, that shouldn't happen. Right? Virtually everybody should play the game very uncooperatively. And we'd expect, at least I would expect, I have a poor view of prisoners, but I'd expect those in prison to be somewhat less cooperative of people, right, than people that are outside prison. Right? You're there because you are not getting along with society in some way, in all likelihood. Right? Or that, or you're using drugs, perhaps. Okay, maybe. Right. But it ends up that they're very willing to cooperate with one another. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, they. I believe when I read about it, they did the one-off game, and that was where that 56% and 30% amongst the pairs came from. And they also did a sequential game where one prisoner chose first, and then that was revealed, so the second prisoner chose based on that. It ends up making it sequential didn't change anything for the prisoners. Yeah, they had about the same proportions. I don't think they did the straight-up repeated game, like we might cover in a game theory course, right, where you take this and repeat it over and over again. Right. Okay. All right. Yeah, so it is interesting we actually do see this. Right? And that suggests that maybe, right, the original numbers that I wrote in here are not quite correct. Right? There are some other incentives in there that we need to consider. Right? So it could be something like, even inside prison, there is a society that you're a part of. Right? And you know that if you play nastily, even in this, you know, stupid economist game, if I play nastily toward my fellow prisoners, that's going to be bad for me later on, even if it's good within the course of the game. Right? There are things that are happening outside this game that can affect it. Right? Okay. And so that's something we need to be very aware of. Okay. How might we use a similar sort of reasoning to deal with something like, say, this public good scenario? I'd suggest, and I don't have room here to write things in, but I think there actually is a marvelous innovation. Right. That can handle these types of problems. Right. That's Kickstarter. Right. The structure of Kickstarter, and there are a few other sites that have similar frameworks, is that we all make pledges, right, and if we hit this total pledge amount, then we actually all have to pay. Right. Now, if I make the pledge and not enough other people pledge, I don't have to pay anything. Right. So that what that effectively does is it takes and it rules out these scenarios where I'm paying and the other person isn't, right, where I get stuck paying the whole cost. So this is gone. Right. The structure of the game is such that we've ruled out this possibility and this possibility. So we either, none of us end up paying or we all end up paying. Right. And then suddenly the incentives become far more clear that I should actually offer to pay for the thing if it's something that I value. Right. Okay. All right. So I'd suggest that we could fund things that even are straight-up real public goods using this type of setup. Okay. And as long as the thing is something that people actually value, there's now an incentive for us to go ahead and pay for it collectively. And we don't end up with, oh, let me try to trick the other person into paying for it without me paying for it. That's no longer a possibility. Okay. All right. And so this is something that we can do. Entrepreneurially, we change the game. Right? We set it up differently. And Kickstarter allows us to do that. Another wonderful example that I absolutely loved. There's a British game show called Golden Balls. And Golden Balls, I don't know a whole lot about how the game itself is played. All I know is that on YouTube, they like to show the last round, which is the splitter steal round, where we have the two people, and they have won some kind of sum of money, and then they have the choice, are they going to split it between the two of them, or is one of them going to try to steal it from the other? Right, and set up this way, so that if we both play split, let's say here the pot was, say, 50,000 pounds, right, if we both play split, we split it evenly, right, so 25 for each of us. If one of us plays steal while the other plays split, whoever plays steal gets the whole thing, whoever plays split gets nothing. If we both play steal, well then, for being such nasty people, we both walk away with nothing. And then we can look at what are the incentives for these individual players. Right. And so, thinking as our column player, if I think the other guy's going to play split, right, well, I should play steal, because after all, 25,000 pounds, that's quite a bit of money. Right? It's probably worthwhile to do this, even on national television. Okay. On the other hand, if I think the other guy's going to play steal, it actually doesn't make any difference whatsoever what I play. Right? So I have every reason to play steal. I have no reason not to play steal. Right? So odds are reasonably good that I should play steal. And the same incentives follow for the second person. Now, the interesting thing is, I think it's relatively rare, at least in these YouTube videos, right, for them both to end up playing steal and walking away with nothing. Right, instead, we end up in the period beforehand, they get to talk to each other about what they're going to do, and, oh, no, you know, I'm going to split, you know, I'm going to split, you know, I'm going to split. And it seems like a very common thing is to have one of them be the person of their word and actually play split, and the other person be the person who actually wants the money, right, and play steal. Right. That's often a combination we see. And whenever I have my students play a very similar game in class, I end up with that kind of thing happening a lot, even without them talking to each other, making any kinds of promises. Okay. So one of them is the nice person. Oh, I'm going to go ahead and play the split equivalent. The other one is the less nice person and plays the steal. Okay. All right. Well, so it ends up it's very tricky. It's very difficult to actually get what we would think would be, on the whole, the good outcome of let's both split the thing, or this is something that's fair. If you look on YouTube, I'd recommend it. I'm not going to show it for copyright reasons. Don't want to get in trouble. But there's this wonderful one. If you search, I believe it's like the most bizarre splitter steal ever, right? Where it was very clear this player was very entrepreneurial as he approached this game. And what he said, right, so he says to the other player, he says, I'm going to play steal. I guarantee you 100% I am going to play steal, and here's what I'll do. If you play split, I'll split the money with you afterward. Because once it's my money, I can do with it whatever I want. Right? So effectively, what this player was trying to do, let's say that he is, say, our blue player here. He's saying, don't even think about this possibility of me playing split. That's not going to happen. Sure. You actually want to see it? Don't even think about that possibility. No, it's not going to happen, not going to happen at all. Instead, what's going to happen is if you play split and I play steal, we're both going to walk away with 25,000. Right? On the other hand, if you play steal, I'm going to play steal. I guarantee it. Right? We both walk away with nothing. Right? So you simplified the game and said, so now go ahead and play split because that's a sensible thing for you to do. Right? And naturally, the other person said, oh, you're bonkers. This is nonsense. You're going to walk away with nothing just because you're being a jerk. Right? But that's not what happened. Right? Instead, the person responded to their actual incentives and said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and split. But it ends up, once we can guarantee, I believe Ibrahim or something like that was the name of the second player, right? Once we guarantee he plays split, now the first player no longer has a reason to play steal. Right? Okay, if I play steal, I have to split it 50-50 because we just made this effectively verbal contract between the two of us. Right? I may as well just go ahead and play split, and we'll split it that way anyway. Right? So we ended up with both players playing split. Interestingly, the jerk who guaranteed he was going to play as a jerk didn't, because he didn't have any reason to anymore once he convinced the other guy. Okay, so this is a very entrepreneurial approach to the use of game theory. Okay. Right, so just to make the point, right, if we approach this from an entrepreneurial standpoint, it changes the way we should approach these games. And we should be very doubtful any time we end up with, say, the standard prisoner's dilemma that says, oh, see, look, the poor prisoners end up in prison for a long time, even though they could have done better. Right? Once we had entrepreneurship, the even though they could have done better doesn't make sense anymore. Right? They're going to change the rules of the game to end up so that they actually do better. One application of that, when I first gave this lecture last year, It was a crazy random happenstance that I had decided to buy this book, Money, Bank, Credit, and Economic Cycles. And I was just flipping through it and happened to flip to page 667, where there's this table there that you certainly cannot see. It's a very small table. And I even bought the pocket version of the book. I have very big pockets. So certainly you cannot see this. Even though I put it there, you probably cannot read it. But he's talking about credit expansion and how individual banks would respond to a world of credit expansion. So I've just reproduced the table here. I like to abbreviate things with, say, dollar signs and the like. So the story that he tells, right, is that if we can manage for all of the banks in the system to expand credit at the same time, right, we can more or less ensure the stability of the system here. And it's extremely profitable for us to do this because we can make all these kinds of loans we couldn't make if we weren't expanding credit. Right? So it's very profitable for us all to expand as long as we all expand together. Right? Now, if none of us expand, then we do make some profits from the relatively few loans that we get to make. Now, where things get tricky is if one bank is expanding credit and another one is not. It's for reasons that Dr. Salerno has talked about. Right? When I expand credit, that's a risky thing to do. Right? I'm going to end up, people are going to be removing reserves from my bank. I could very easily run into liquidity problems or solvency problems. Right? So we end up, if one expands credit while the other one doesn't, the one that doesn't expand credit gets to survive, right? While the one that does expand credit ends up ultimately failing. It can't actually satisfy all of the claims that are made against it. Right, so we have that possibility. So then we can look at what our incentives are. Right, so if I, say, the role player, right, I have the choice. If I believe the other bank is going to expand, right, I can either just survive by not expanding, right, or I can earn extremely high profits by expanding as well. On the other hand, if I believe the other bank isn't going to expand, right, then I would end up failing if I expand, so I'd rather not expand. Okay. All right. And we end up, for our blue player that's choosing our column, exactly the same incentives. It's better to earn a high profit, my $3 signs, right, rather than just surviving. At the same time, it's better to earn something than to fail. Right. So it ends up there are two possibilities that actually either one would kind of make sense, right, and that is either we all expand, right, it makes sense for me to expand as long as everyone else does, right, or none of us expand. If others are not expanding, it doesn't make sense for me to go ahead and expand. It's way too dangerous. All right, so this is a case where, like, using the standard approach doesn't even narrow down what banks are going to do. We're all going to do the same thing. What that is, we really don't know. Right. Okay. This is actually the type of game we call a coordination game. There are two different possibilities. The important thing is just that we all coordinate with each other to end up with one of these possibilities. Right? I think the proper way for us to approach this is not to say, well, we might possibly end up not expanding. Instead, it's to say that banks clearly have an incentive to try to create institutions around them, right, that will guarantee the expansionary outcome. Right? So then the question just becomes, right, what do we have to do to make sure that all these other banks are expanding? Yeah.
Would it make more sense for a bank to want to survive when another bank fails? Hmm? Wouldn't that be better for them than when they're both existing?
Hmm.
Right.
Right. Yeah. I guess it depends.
Because
right.
Like in the don't.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I guess one could definitely make a pretty good argument that profits here are higher than here. Between, say, profits here, where you're surviving and the other one fails, and here, I don't think it's quite so clear. Because on the one hand, it is true you are surviving, you just lost a competitor. That's a good thing for your profits. But at the same time, credit expansion is outrageously profitable in itself. So it's not immediately obvious to me which one is the more profitable thing. I would tend to go with all of us expanding. Yeah?
Okay. Survive just means, I make a ton of money. It's just later. Whereas
sure.
Here, if we both expand, I make a lot of money sooner, but there's obviously going to be consequences.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Time preference certainly could play a role here. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Right. Yeah. Because, yeah, like you said, survival means I'm making smaller profits now. I can make up for that in the future. Question is, how do I balance these out? Sure. Sure. So, yeah, I gave the economist answer, it depends. And someone more insightful from the audience told me what it depended on. So, that's good. That's good. No, I very much believe we need to add to each other's knowledge. And I need to have knowledge added to mine all the time. Right? So, that's actually a very, very good point. Yeah. Okay. So back to the point I was trying to make before I was insightfully interrupted. So what we do know is if we all expand, that is something that's going to be outrageously profitable for all of us. So what we want to do is try to design institutions around us that will ensure this expansion happens. Right? So we might want to say, as the blue bank, the one choosing our column, I want to make sure that this other guy, right, has a reason to go ahead and expand credit. So maybe we'll want to develop a system where you don't necessarily fail if you expand. Right? Say we have some kind of fund to bail you out. Right, so we might say you want to establish a system where there's a lender of last resort. So if you have some kind of liquidity crisis, you know, money is flowing out of your vault so fast that we can provide that liquidity to you. Right, so we end up with, say, a central bank that has the lender of last resort responsibility. And that prevents this type of failure. Right, so now, okay, it becomes more tempting. It's not as risky for us to all go ahead and expand credit together. Right, when we find that we don't like the game, right, the players change the game. It is something that we can actually do institutionally. All right. So, just to sum up the points that I was hoping to make, right, when we first see this prisoner's dilemma, right, we should be doubtful about it. Right? Trust that intuition. Right? It doesn't actually make sense once we establish a larger view, including entrepreneurs, that can actually foresee things and can change the way the game is played. And that is something that is actually a possibility when we go out into the real world. So now I think we have lots of time. Yes, almost half our time for questions, which I like. So, like I said, you're more insightful than I much of the time. Yeah.
Hypothetically, let's say that we reject all the insights you made and we take game theory at its face value.
Sure.
Would the argument not be made that all governments are being highly redistributionary and income taxes and taxes in general are not even? Would it still not be that some are overpaying and some are free riding?
Here the point is that, here the point is if we look at, say, a case like the public goods, couldn't we make the argument that, in effect, even though we're taxing people to provide these public goods, couldn't it still end up being largely redistributionary? Right, so we end up with some people who are overpaying, who are, in effect, say, paying more for the military than they would choose to themselves, while there are others that are effectively free riding or getting, say, a disproportionately good value. And that's certainly a possibility. Yeah. One of the tricks is that it's one thing to say, well, we could improve the outcome by making sure this thing gets paid for. It's another thing to actually pay for it in a way that everyone is made better off. That's extremely difficult, especially when we consider that there is a fundamental information problem, right, and that when I refuse to pay for a good, we don't know whether it's because I'm hoping to free ride on somebody else paying for it, or that it's because I just don't like the good. Right? Okay, maybe I don't want to pay for military because I'm a pacifist and I think militaries are a bad thing. I'd rather not have that type of protection. Or maybe it's that I'm hoping the people next door are going to pay for it and they'll take care of me. Right? We can't tell, right? Which makes it extremely difficult to actually get an outcome like this. With these two people where we assume we already know what their values are, it's very simple. Right? But there is a world of difference between what I consider chalkboard economics and economics in the real world, where we don't actually know what the values are. All we know are what people's actions are.
Sure.
Sure. Yeah, I don't.
Exactly using this game theory, but you just in the opposite way.
Okay.
You justify that state should exist.
Sure.
So it's kind of something fishy for me about this game theory, because how can you justify opposite things by game theory? And another thing here is, let's say if you have this free market security and defense.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that some guys will be like freeloaders,
mm-hmm.
and the others will pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay for me. Someone who is paying may just be willing to pay for freeloaders as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this system, why should the system exist? I do not think that it's like a contradiction to the existence of the like anarcho-capitalist world.
Sure. Just to make the point here, I think it's true that a lot of people, when they use game theory, are really using it to justify state intervention, absolutely. Right. So this is how we make sure roads are paid for, the military is paid for, or research is paid for. These are all things that might be labeled public goods. We have to tax people to make sure they're out there. I think that's a typical argument. But I like the point you make. And then, okay, maybe there is some free riding. So what? Right? Okay, maybe this happens in this free society where we have, you know, these voluntary organizations. As long as they end up, you know, being funded in proportion to how much people value them, that's fine. Right? I would also think it's certainly true in our society that there are people that pay for other people to have benefits for things. Right? People do actually give to charity. Right? And to a certain degree, I do that because, you know, I think I have a moral responsibility or it makes me feel good. But a lot of it's because I like knowing that other people are being made better off. Right? So I'm very willing to pay part of the cost for certain people to eat. Or say with the example of Kiva. I really like Kiva. Right? Kiva.org makes these microloans, right, in the developing world, so that people can get businesses off the ground. Right? And in exchange for me providing my funds, I get absolutely no interest payments. Well, that's not strictly true. Right? My interest payment is I'm feeling somewhat better about helping the developing world actually develop. Right? So I guess in a sense, right, there's a certain amount of free riding that might be going on there. It doesn't really matter. Like you said, there's a so what. Let's go ahead and do it anyway. Right. As long as someone's willing to pay the cost, we've got it. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point. Brings up the point that Jeff Hummel makes, that overproduction of a good, in effect, can change the nature of the good. And I think that's especially true, like you said, with, say, the military or things that are funded by taxes. Because it seems to me it should be obvious to people that when you fund things with taxes, that is different than funding it through voluntary contributions of some kind, right? Me buying the thing or what have you, simply because it changes the incentives remarkably. And that now, really, the military's job is to make sure that these taxes are able to be collected. I don't necessarily know that I want to have a military that has that as its job. I'd rather have a military that has its job be actually protecting me. And if I'm paying them voluntarily and they stop doing that, then I can cut it off. Taxes are very different because they're not voluntary. Okay, yeah, it definitely does change the nature of things. The military wants to make sure it looks important. Perhaps beyond, right, its more appropriate level of importance, depending on how we define appropriate. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Is there room in that banking example for the situation where they both stand and they agree dollar signs? Is there room for a third actor to come in and say, oh, I'm going to run an honest institution, and that has a chance for $4 signs?
Right. Yeah. That's a good question. Like, what happens when we start expanding these off of our two dimensions? Right? Well, I guess the first thing that happens is that I have to start drawing on cubes, and that becomes very complicated. It's just a very bad joke, right? Okay. Right. So, what happens if somebody comes in this expansionary economy or this expansionary banking system and says, "I'm not going to"? Okay. Now, there, I think that the argument that Huerta de Soto would make, and I think he's basically right, is that we can kind of think of the system as it previously existed as just kind of acting as one player at that point. Right? So we have the previous system is all expanding credit, while this new player is not expanding credit. Right? So we'd end up with this type of situation where the one that doesn't expand credit, that is the new entrant, is going to survive while the others are going to fail. Right? How profitable that will be? depends on this trade-off again. Right? How much are people willing to pay for a more stable banking institution? But at the same time, we know that there will be a very strong incentive for those pre-established banks to do two things. Right? One is to make it very difficult for new entrants to come in. Right? And I don't think it's stretching too much to say that a lot of the regulations that have existed historically have actually had that explicit purpose. Right? For example, it's very difficult to just go out and start my own bank. I can't put a sign out in front of my house and say, oh, I'm willing to accept deposits, and I'll just keep them here in my basement. Right? And don't worry, I have theft insurance, right? So you're fine. One would think that technically it wouldn't be that difficult to start a bank that runs this way. All you need is the space to put the money. But I'm not allowed to legally. Right? There's this whole chartering process we have to go through where I have to qualify and all this. And I think, yeah, it's explicitly there. To prevent that kind of problem. Right? And then you add to it, well, fine, if that doesn't work, right, we want to make sure that this person, once they're in the fold, right, we actually take them all the way into the expansionary fold. Right? Give them the same incentives the rest of us have. Right? So once you join, we make sure you're covered by, say, FDIC insurance, so that you don't have to, depositors don't have to worry about you failing if you actually make these horrible loans through expansionary credit and the like. Right? And so, yeah, the system's set up so that it's very difficult to enter, and if you do enter, you have every reason just to follow suit with everyone else. So, yeah, I've often wondered, like, maybe I should give up economics and just go into banking and try to be an honest banker. But then I get very pessimistic when I look at the banking system. See? The fact that I don't see banks doing that suggests there's a really strong reason not to in the system as we have it. Yeah. Yes?
The only $1 sign.
Right.
But wouldn't that not make any sense? Because the whole point is you're going to then monopolize in the future. Mm-hmm. If you're assuming free entry, then someone can do the same thing to you. So the only two possible are those two, because there is no benefit of survival over some profits, because if you have the assumption of anyone can enter, then you can't monopolize.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think it's absolutely true. If we expand this game out through time and allow for something like free entry, yeah. The survival profits, yeah, at best, should be down here, right? Unless we all hop on the expansionary boat later on, right? Right, right. So, yeah, we would still end up only with the corners. Yeah, that makes sense. As long, you know, once again, assuming that we don't have limits on entry. Right? If there's some way for me to establish myself as purely a monopoly bank and to maintain that somehow, then, okay, then I could be sympathetic to these arguments becoming really high later on. But it's certainly true if they were, there'd be a strong incentive for new banks to try to find a way to enter. It's just a matter of, do we have the institutions preventing them or not? Right. Sure. Sure. Yeah, I think that's a strong point. Okay. All right. Yes?
Did you see that in that study with the prison? Mm-hmm. They also did a study on college.
Yes. Yes. It was very interesting. Yeah. 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 In the same study, I guess, I don't know which you want to consider experiment and control here. Yeah, but they also studied female college students, try to keep things similar, at least along that line. Yeah, and found that college students are much less cooperative. Than prisoners are, which is kind of wild. Right? Actually, when they do these studies on, say, economics majors versus economics majors are just terrible people. Right? It's true. Right? I think a lot because, right, when you're trained in economics, right, we have this view of rationality you get in the mainstream classroom that really includes selfishness, right? Like, part of the strict definition of rationality is that you really only consider your own well-being, right? After all, really all we would need, if I could find where I put that, right, if we could take these years in prison and just have our prisoners care about each other enough, we could end up with a different outcome, right? But yeah, in fact, I'm willing to take a certain hit to make sure my friend doesn't end up in prison. Right, but then what do we call this in an economics classroom? Say, oh, that's irrational. Right? Well, irrational is clearly a bad thing because irrational means crazy. Right? Well, yeah, in common speech, yes. Right? In the economics classroom, no. Right? Irrational means that you're a person rather than the strict set of assumptions that doesn't actually match anybody. Right? Right? So I think that there is kind of this, I don't know, we get a training in uncooperability, or I'll make up words. I'm allowed to do that. That's what a PhD gives you, right? So uncooperability, sure. Right, we're trained to be less cooperative. in a sense. And I wonder if it's just a similar thing happening with college students in general. We're training you to, you're obviously intelligent people, you can think through what's best for yourself, that kind of thing. So you end up becoming less cooperative as a result in this type of structure, which is kind of wild. Yeah.
I think with the going back to the banker game theory,
sure.
I think what that shows is the incentive for banks or bank owners with a lower time preference to actually try and form not just a cartel, but a government-enforced cartel.
Okay.
So let's say 95 out of 100 banksters, you know, we all want to do this expansionary policy. Mm-hmm. Like, say, the Peter Schiff or the Engelhardt Bank, they're like, no, we're gonna keep our 100% reserves and we're gonna stay back out of this. We're like, well, you know, those other five guys are gonna screw us because they're gonna come out on top again. So we'll have the state do it, make this forced cartel, which we call the Federal Reserve System, where all the banks inflate at a uniform rate. And so no amount of currency is rushing into another. And you know, we force these other guys to cooperate and we all get to expand and get all this money.
Right. Oh, yeah, I think that absolutely makes sense. Yeah. Yeah, that really, the story this tells, once we expand it out further, right, is, yeah, the creation of a banking cartel of some sort, right, to ensure this cooperation between all of us, and thereby either driving out or corrupting, right, the more honest folks, right, that are trying not to expand credit.
So
yeah, absolutely.
The state acts as that third guy who's breaking the kneecaps.
Right. Sure, yeah, potentially, yeah, the state could be drawn in this. In this type of role, I guess. Yeah, and that's the way we can think of, say, things like chartering requirements and the like. If I do try to open my own bank with just a sign in my front yard, yeah, odds are somebody's going to come by and break my kneecaps, right? Right. And odds are it's probably not going to be the mafia, right? It's going to be somebody wearing a much more official uniform. Right? Yeah. Not literally break my kneecaps, probably. I'm wimpy enough, I'd say, okay, cuff me, and I'd go. I don't look that threatening, I hope. Right. Right. But the fact is I would be shot down forcibly. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
I'm pretty sure it was your speech yesterday. You said it's consistent with how, like, in bubbles, good behavior is not bad behavior. Uh-huh. Or bad behavior is not good behavior.
Right. Right. Yeah. Okay. You're going to force me to talk about it explicitly, aren't you? Okay. Here we get to talk a little bit about some of the problems that I have with the Curley-Dempster approach. Which is kind of this game theoretic approach to why are we all hopping in a bubble, right? Okay. And I think it should make sense once we apply the stuff I've just said about game theory and entrepreneurship, and then we look at what the game theoretic approach is telling us, right? Right, and it's slightly different, right, than, let's say, the banking example is, right? So here we're thinking about businesses deciding either to invest or not invest in a boom, right? Right, so I could invest, or I could not. I could invest, or I could not. Let me get all my slashes in here to keep things clear. Okay. Right. And kind of the story is that if we both invest, right, we get lots of investment in the boom, that means we have lots of malinvestments, right, and we end up with a bubble. And here's where they'd make some argument about relative profits. And, well, it's true, okay, during the boom, we're all earning great profits. During the bust, we're all earning terrible profits, but we're all at least doing the same as each other. Okay. Whereas if, say, during this boom, one decides to invest and the other doesn't, right, then the one that invests earns a relatively high profit. I'll just abbreviate REL for relative profit. While those that doesn't invest or restricts their investment would earn less, right? So I guess low relative profit. And then we just reverse things down here. The one that invests earning the high profit. The one that doesn't earning the low profit in the course of the boom. Okay. And now if neither of us invest, we end up with no boom at all. Right. Right. No bubble or no boom bust. Because nobody's making those malinvestments. Right. And more or less what the argument is, then I'll talk about some of my problems with it. If you want to see these all laid out, there's a paper I published last year where I spent some significant time talking about Curley and Dempster and why I don't like them. I, personally, they're fine. I've not met them, but I don't like their argument. Okay, so the question then becomes, right, why is it we all end up investing? And they would say something like, well, if I think the others aren't going to invest, right, so if I'm, say, choosing the row, I think the others aren't going to invest, I'd rather earn a high relative profit than not. Right, so I have a reason to do this. Right, and I'd rather be part of a bubble earning the same relative profit as everyone else than earning a low relative profit. Right, so I want to go ahead and invest into the bubble. And the same thing goes for everyone else. Okay. You're getting to my point. Yeah. Okay. Right. So we all end up investing. We create this bubble. Right. Despite the fact we actually know that if nobody did, right, if we saw this expansionary monetary policy, we knew what it was, we just said, see ya, right, we're not going to do it. We could actually prevent the bubble happening. This is an argument that Mises himself makes. Right? He criticizes his theory before it's even fully formed in saying, if everybody realizes what's happening, it is possible that nobody's going to participate and it won't happen. Right? Okay. Then the question is, how do we deal with this? This is one possibility. Right? A few reasons I don't like this. Yeah, one being, it should be obvious to most people, is that if we take a long-run view, right, it is better for us not to have the bubble than to have the bubble. Right, so what this story actually says in my mind is that there's an incentive for the investors involved to develop institutions that would prevent us from investing into a bubble. Right, very much like, I guess this is somewhat analogous, but on the flip side of expanding credit, right, if we all expand credit, things are good for us, so we should create institutions to make that happen. Here, if we understand that bubbles do in fact pop, right, and it's going to, in the end, be very bad for us, for all of us here, then we're going to try to develop institutions that will prevent us from all investing into the bubble. Right, so I don't know that it actually solves the problem, right, once we start thinking about entrepreneurship more seriously. Right, so the question really should be, right, why don't these institutions exist? And that's something that this story doesn't tell us. Right? To me, this says, you know, the incentive really should be, how do we make this happen? And then the question is, why doesn't it happen? Right? So I don't think this is a great answer for that reason. I am also very suspicious of things like when we look at relative profit. I find that kind of fishy. Right? This also seems to take an extremely short-run view. Well, if we believe that entrepreneurs have foresight, they're more interested in the long run, or at least somewhat interested in the long run. And if we believe that capitalists are funding things because they have relatively low time preference, they're certainly interested in the longer run. Right, so we don't just see the bubble, we also see the bust happening after that and should take that into account. Okay. And so I think this is fishy. Right? So that's where I very much prefer the view that, well, we have this spectrum of entrepreneurs, right, and the really good ones actually do get out, right, but that leaves these really bad ones. Right? And I think that actually helps explain why we don't have institutions to prevent the bubble. Right? Those that foresee it can very easily get out of it. Right? You just sell and wait. And they really don't necessarily have a strong reason to pull the stupid people that are hopping into the bubble. They don't have a reason to pull them over to the right side. Just go ahead and let them invest. It's their own dime. So, yeah, I find this fishy and prefer that heterogeneous entrepreneurs, some are good, some aren't, kind of explanation. And I think it explains why don't we get the institutions as well. Yeah. Sure.
Game theory didn't take into account competition.
Okay.
Let's say all those guys are like substitutes. Okay?
Sure.
Yeah, but when they're competing, it's all about individual kind of market.
Okay.
So it creates everything better for society.
Mm-hmm.
So how it's in here, I just couldn't get it.
Right, yeah. I think it's true that one of the limitations of game theory is that it really works best when there are only a very small number of competitors and a fixed number of competitors. Once we start entering in the possibility of, say, more coming in, right, so competition would be more fierce, then that becomes problematic for applying game theory at all. Right? We need to take another approach. Just because game theory is not designed to deal with that. It's designed for these very small situations. And we can expand it to some degree. And it does get slightly more complicated. We can't add a third actor. And we don't quite have to make a cube, but something close to it. Say, okay, here we have one table. This is where player three's investing. Here's another table where they're not investing. We could do that. We can also make it more complicated by saying, well, the reality is you don't invest or not. Right? You pick some amount you invest. Right? We can make that more complicated, too. Eventually gets to the point where it stops making sense to use this framework because it's gotten so complicated we should do something else. Right? So, yeah, I think it's a limited tool. But at the same time, you know, market economics is a limited tool. It makes sense when we have a market. If we don't have a market, then we need some other logical method to deduce what's going to happen. So it's limited. But I'm okay with that. Just don't use it for everything, and you're okay. Yeah.
Do you have any opinions on some of the cooperative issues of game theory, like voting or auctions, things like that?
No. Do I have anything to say about these cooperative issues? Is there any one you have in mind in particular?
I don't know, maybe like power indexes of voting coalitions.
Okay, I don't know anything about power indexes, honestly. I don't know anything about that at all. Guess what? Wisdom is knowing your own ignorance, perhaps. So I'm very wise, but I know very little. I do find some of the applications very interesting, thinking about, say, Arrow's impossibility theorem, right, which suggests that it's basically impossible to have a good voting system that actually satisfies society's preferences. I find that very interesting, but it's one of those things where the argument, some of the assumptions feel kind of dicey to me, so I don't know how much I should believe it. At the same time, I like the conclusion enough, I go with it. Right? There is no good voting system. Yeah, I like that. Let's go with it. Right. I think a lot of the stuff you're talking about, I don't know enough about. A lot of the time I hear the conclusions and I like it. I look at the assumptions, I don't. And then I move on with my life and do something I know more about. So, yeah. I guess that means there's room here for you to do something with that. To come up here a few years from now and talk about cooperative game theory and what we can say about it. Sure. Yeah. Or to teach me about it, and then I'll try to work it in. Either one works. Okay. All right. Any other questions? I think we have time for one or two more. Yes, sir.
It's a little off topic, but I was curious in your courses in teaching, do you have freedom to choose your own textbooks, or are you mandated to teach
others? Okay. Right. Right, yeah, where I teach, I get to pick whatever textbook I like. I tend to use more standard textbook, just because it doesn't look as fishy. Although I have switched to a textbook that's not very standard, but is very cheap. It's like a $20 textbook, something like that. And then I just tell the students that lecture notes matter more. There we go. Right. If you want to get a sense of, say, when I teach principles of micro, I actually have everything posted on YouTube, because I just taught an online version of it. You'll see, it's kind of an odd mix of a more mainstream view and an Austrian view, right, going back and forth between the two. I have to understand the institution that I'm inside as well. You get a mix of truth and falsehood. And the reality is, when you talk about a principles course, there's so much that we agree on. I can teach supply and demand without any qualms. I say, okay, I'm really lying to them. No, that's not true, right? I kind of doubt, should I have them draw so many graphs? Kind of get worried about that, but I just go with it, right? Just swallow hard and move forward. But there is so much that we agree on at that level that I don't feel many qualms about it. So. If you look, YouTube, my channel is Prof. Engelhart. There's Prof. and then my last name. My last name is hard to spell, so keep your notes with you. I think they actually got it right in the program here. So type it in that way and you're good. It ends up, Google is brilliant. Right? Google can correct the spelling of my last name. So you just put Lucas Engelhart spelled almost any way. But if you put my middle initial in there, Lucas M. Engelhart, it will find me. Because it ends up there are only two that I found anyway. There are only two Lucas Engelharts in the world. Right? One is me. The other one is a German kid who's a little bit younger than me. I think he's maybe like 20, something like that. And he does like BMX biking, this kind of stuff. Right? So if you see somebody that doesn't look like me and they're on bikes, you've gone the wrong place. Yeah. He is my Facebook friend, though, which is kind of fun to do. Yeah, I don't know. I don't understand anything he posts because it's all in German. I think I know three German words, but okay. But anyway, yeah, I have a lot of freedom. That's not true everywhere. And I guess I also have the benefit, at Kent State, I'm at a branch campus where, when I was first hired, I could boast that on my campus we had 100% Austrian faculty, because it was me, right? It was one. Or now at 50%, we hired another guy who isn't an Austrian. But that kind of gives me a lot of freedom, because the rest of the department down the street doesn't necessarily know a lot of what I do. And they're okay with that. As long as they're okay with that, I'm okay with that. So I think there's something to be said for flying under the radar to some degree. Yeah. Okay. All right. Oh, and that is time. All right. Well, thank you very much.